Writing of a structure at scale is hard. It's messy, it's complicated, and it has a tendency to go sideways in the middle of the night. Rather than talk about the idealized versions of things, we're going to talk about the rough edges. We're going to talk about what it's really like running infrastructure at scale. Welcome to the Real World DevOps Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Julian, editor and analyst for Monitoring Weekly and author of O'Reilly's Practical Monitoring. This episode is sponsored by the lovely folks at Influx Data. If you're listening to this podcast, you're probably also interested in better monitoring tools, and that's where Influx comes in. Personally, I'm a huge fan of their products, and I often recommend them to my own clients. You're probably familiar with their time series database, InfluxDB, but you may not be as familiar with their other tools. Telegraph for metrics collection from systems, Chronograph for visualization, and Capacitor for real-time streaming. All of this is available as open source, and they also have a hosted commercial version too. You can check all of this out at influxdata.com.
Hi, everyone. My name is Mike Julian. I'm here with Elliot Murphy, the CEO of Kindly Ops. Welcome to the show, Elliot.
Hey, nice to be here.
So why don't you tell us a bit about what you and Kindly Ops does?
Yeah, so we're a cybersecurity consulting firm, and we mostly help regulated companies, biotechs and fintechs, with governance, risk, and compliance. We take a DevOps approach, so all of the sort of good practices from that world, and apply them into what's traditionally been a pretty boring and bureaucratic set of activities.
Okay, so what are these regulations we're talking about?
So some people have heard 1,000 times before, HIPAA, PCI, SOC 2. Others are a little newer, GDPR, or more specialized like FSMA. There's, regulations from the Food and Drug Administration around medications and therapeutics. Pretty much every country in the world has their, and every industry has their own set of regulations or laws. So as software technology sort of expands ever further into different parts of business, even very old businesses that didn't have much technology in the past, there's regulations that people have to comply with.
Okay, so that makes a lot of sense, but every time I've been in a company with these regulatory requirements, it's really just been a huge pain in the ass. Like, I don't like dealing with it, and no one I've worked with likes dealing with it. So we kind of meet the bare minimum and hope for the best. So how do you view these regulations? Do you have that same take on them?
So it's funny. A few years ago, I was working as the CTO of a healthcare startup, founded by a doctor. She had just some amazing innovations, and I got to see firsthand like how expensive and burdensome regulatory compliance was. And then even more upsetting, as I was meeting people, scientists and researchers at universities, I was hearing all these stories of how they were discouraged or prevented or like didn't want to bother bringing like actual life-saving innovations to market because of the burden of regulatory compliance. So I'm right there with you that like by default, they can have a pretty high cost. And so sort of our entire mission has been like to try and get the value out of those regulations, but without the sort of human toil, right? So like it's a pretty existential question, why even have rules and laws?
Right.
I think some rules and laws are good. But they don't have to be as miserable as they have been, right? Like we really take a human-centric approach.
Okay. So what does that even mean? Like a human-centric approach to regulation? Like regulations are, to me, they're handed down from on high. So it's like you comply or face the consequences.
Yeah. So it's funny. We've actually developed like this four-step process, and it's very, very common. When you're talking with people who are excited about building products and are excited about serving patients and customers and are just excited about doing their core job, they're usually pretty annoyed at like externally imposed rules or that aren't quite obvious how they're beneficial. And so, depending on people's life experiences, they have like these different perspectives. Some people, particularly if they've been doing risk and compliance work for their whole career, like they see the value and they get frustrated that other people push back on regulations. So, like, what does it actually mean to put people first? We start with building empathy for different worldviews. So like one definition of culture is that it's beliefs and assumptions that drive decisions and behavior. So that kind of makes sense. But then if you think about that again, like what is another word for beliefs and assumptions that you use to make decisions, drive behavior? Those are mental models. And so that's like a very freeing like realization that like, okay, mm-hmm. what we're actually talking about when we say culture, security culture, for example, are mental models. And you and I are going to have our favorite mental models, our default mental models, the mental models we go back to immediately when we're in a high stress situation. But we're perfectly capable of learning other worldviews, other mental models, and deciding when it's beneficial to apply them, right? We can try them on for size and we can say, oh, like, yeah, I can see, even though this is not my favorite way to think about the problem, I can see there's some utility in this case for that.
Yeah.
So Dr. Lance Hayden actually developed this fantastic Creative Commons licensed security culture diagnostic. It's called, in his book, People-Centric Security. And so that outlines like four different sort of cultures or mental models. There's a trust culture, an autonomy culture, a compliance culture, and a process culture. And you see so strongly in every single company that I go into, they have one that they really prefer, one or two that they really prefer and tends to like be their sort of default identity. And then they're usually struggling with getting proficient at using the other ones when appropriate. So if it's a large organization, a government organization, a healthcare organization, they're going to tend to be really, really strong process culture or compliance culture. They're really typically struggling to take calculated risks, do innovation, to build trust and collaboration. Startups, nonprofits tend to be very, very strong with trust culture and autonomy culture. You live or die on your own. You get to innovate. You can do anything you want. We care mostly about the people in our relationships, but they really tend to struggle when it comes time to deal with compliance or deal with a stronger process. So that very first thing we do is just give people sort of the tools and the language to understand that there are multiple valid mental models and that it's worth understanding and empathizing with people who might be coming from a different preferred one.
That's such a fantastic way to look at it. I used to work for the Department of Energy, and we were really strong on process. I mean, my facility that I worked at was part of the Manhattan Project. So we'd been around since the 1940s. So we were really big on process and really big on compliance. We actually had a risk management team. Like, that's all they did. We called them the non-technical side of security.
Yep.
But anytime someone wanted to do a thing, like if security wanted to implement some new process, it had to go through risk management. Risk management's default answer was no. So much so that I would often go to the director of risk management and say, hey, I have a question or I have an idea. And he'd look up and say no. And just deadpan. And like, that was the end of discussion. He hadn't heard my idea. It's just to him, no. Like, why add anything? We don't need it. We're fine. Compliance is already working. Why change it?
Yeah. It can be extremely frustrating. And it can also be frustrating for people in those same organizations who are looking at the massive amounts of money they're investing and setting at the same time they're trying to uphold the process and compliance stuff. They're trying to innovate, they're trying to do new things, and they're frustrated at the speed of delivery or the speed of lack of delivery.
Right. Yeah, definitely been there too. but on the other side, you've talked about these startups. It's a common thing where a small scrappy startup will get acquired by a giant behemoth. For example, like say a bank acquires a small fintech startup. Mm-hmm. Well, the fintech startup is used to moving quickly and kind of playing fast and loose with compliance rules, and they get acquired by a bank. And the bank is, they're experts at compliance and process, whereas the startup is, they're experts at the other two you've been talking about. So yeah. Like now you get kind of a clash of cultures going on.
Yeah, there absolutely is a clash of cultures. And one of the big ideas in DevOps is you need to understand like the rest of the business, right? Don't just do your technology stuff in a vacuum, but understand the business. And understanding that regulatory controls are crucial to those businesses is absolutely necessary. I think the reason the banks care so much about that is because they will lose their banking license if they don't comply. And when you get those clash of cultures, particularly in startups, one of my favorite ways to try and explain it is to explain that there's kind of two buckets of work. So one is doing a good job. And usually, technical people who are building product in a startup, they are super excited about doing a good job. That's why they come to work in the morning. The second half of the work is getting credit for doing a good job. And that's where they're sometimes digging in their heels and doing a terrible job at first of communicating and showing evidence and getting credit for the good work that they've already done. And so a lot of what we do to help people is help them understand, like, listen, there are things that you can do that will generate automated evidence that will make your existing good work more visible and transparent to the rest of the business, and you can start getting credit for it.
Okay. How does that actually work? Like, well, how would you approach such a thing of trying to both doing compliance and getting the credit for doing that compliance work, especially considering a lot of your peers aren't going to really care?
Yeah. So, In our four-step process, we talked about the first step being build empathy. The second thing we typically do, and this is on the startup side, right? Like someone who's trying to come into this world, is put in place a controls baseline.
And okay, so, what does that mean?
So you're typically going to have imposed on you some set of regulations that you need to comply with, right? So it might have been decided you're going to do SOC 2. Because of the nature of your business, it might be PCI or HIPAA. And then associated with those set of regulations are going to be a set of controls, required controls. Or you might just be trying to make part of the company more mature. And so a thing I've been seeing take off a lot in the last year is the NIST cybersecurity framework, the CSF.
So yeah, that's a great framework.
Yeah, banks are using it. Other companies are using it. So those, even companies that might not necessarily have a more specific thing like SOC 2 or HIPAA or GDPR, they're still picking up this cybersecurity framework just because of concern of the sometimes scary security environment that we're operating in. This is where all of the good practices of DevOps about removing toil and doing automation and using version control and code for expressing policy comes into play in a big way. So instead of all kinds of manual checks around controls that are really frustrating, you can enhance your continuous delivery pipelines to do a lot of those checks for you quicker, faster, easier. And the important thing there is the right way to do something, the safe way to do something, has to be the most convenient way to do it. If you make it more convenient to have your builds pass the security checks, that's the way everybody's going to do it. And fundamentally, right, everybody showed up to work that day to do a good job anyway. They get frustrated when they see things done in a really inefficient way. And so taking that controls baseline and making sure you automate it as much as possible, integrate it natively into your cloud systems and all of the other systems that you're using, people get right on board. They're super happy with it. And they get excited when it finds things for them. They're like, oh, this server build, blah, 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 is non-compliant and I can fix it. And it's amazing the engagement you see.
Yeah, absolutely. I was looking on your website and saw that you gave a talk a couple of years ago where in the talk you made a comment about it. Many years ago, it used to be that people would complain about version control adding overhead and therefore we're not going to use it because it slows us down. But that has continually happened with every new thing we have. And yet we wouldn't look at version control and say, no, that adds overhead, that would slow us down. In fact, it's quite the opposite.
Yeah, if it's slowing you down, you're doing it wrong.
Not use it. Yeah. So now it's like, if we don't use it, it's going to slow us down.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you think we're going to get there with security too?
So I'm gonna say we're gonna get there with risk.
Okay.
So security is like one component of risk.
Okay.
There's a lot of technology change in the security environment happening very, very rapidly. There's a lot of technology change happening in general. And so it's I don't see that stabilizing the way version control as a particular technique has stabilized, right? There's a ton of change that's going to keep happening there for the next 10 years.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But where I am seeing a total breakthrough and shift is in risk. And that's actually step three of our four-step process. So once you have a controls baseline in place, controls are like, and compliance in general, is like a minimum bar, a lowest common denominator. It might cause a bunch of improvement in your organization to get you up to that minimum bar, but it doesn't in any way guarantee continuous improvement that in year two, three, and four, you're going to continue to get better. And that's where doing risk analysis comes in. So a lot of people, most people that I've talked to, their experience with risk, you know, you talked about working with the risk team at Department of Energy, has been qualitative, right? We've got low, medium, and high risks, one through five.
Yep.
and that is frustrating for people because it's an intellectually terrible way to think about the problem. It's primitive. It's not okay. There's so much better ways to deal with it. And so the better way to deal with it is called quantitative risk assessment instead of qualitative. And so there's actually an open standard. I think it was published in 2009, and it's only now starting to take off. But you can do quantitative risk assessment, and you can actually make significantly better decisions on the risk that you're taking on. So like Peter Drucker famously said that all profit in business comes from risk. And when you're trying to have detailed debates about, do we need this control or that control, or does this regulation make any sense? Can we just accept this risk versus needing to do something about it? How do you make that conversation meaningful? Like the entire point of all of that stuff, of all of that debate, is to give you a better quality decision to on the risk that you're going to take in the business. You might decide not to do that part of the business. You might decide to buy some insurance and transfer risk. You might decide to have some new controls. You might decide you're spending way too much on controls that aren't actually helping your risk and get rid of them. And so that quantitative-based risk analysis with the Open FAIR standard is the thing that everybody working around security, around technology, is going to have to be conversant in. It's just such a better, you have a better quality conversation.
That's an incredible insight, because how my own experience working with risk management and people that are focused on compliance, how they, or at least how I view their view of this, is that they're trying to get rid of all risk. But what you're saying is that's not really possible. Mm-mm. And it's not actually the job anyways. What we're actually talking about is understanding what the risk is and then coming up with ways to determine what we should do about it. How much risk are we willing to accept?
Exactly. And that's where things get really exciting, right? Because even the most controversial statements, right? So engineers love to be contrary when we're first talking about quantitative risk. And they, they, you know, like to throw up these cases of like, well, some things you can't put a financial value on. And like, what about the value of human life? And all of this stuff. And if you really just step back and realize, like, there are very different risk profiles for people, like very different risk tolerances. And even something that seems on its face to be obvious, I'll just use an example of some medication, right? So say, what if there was a medication that if you took this medication, there was a 25% chance it would kill you? That sounds terrible, right? It's like, shouldn't do that.
But yeah.
What if you were a person who had a 1% chance of living another 6 months because of your cancer or something else?
Now, I might consider taking that risk now.
I think most people would take the medicine.
Right.
It's that is, and so that's why, like, actually having a structured conversation about the risk is so crucial, because you actually get really good quality decisions that take, like, reality into account versus mm-hmm. just like high, medium, low. We're not doing anything. We don't accept high risk in this organization. That doesn't make any sense. But going like, well, given this scenario, this is an appropriate trade-off, and we've done the analysis. You actually have the analysis that you can show, and that's getting credit for your work, right? And so mm-hmm. that's a case where it actually starts to enable you to take on more risk than you would have been able to take on without putting in the work. And this is why, like, just security isn't enough, just compliance isn't enough. Like, this whole world of governance, risk, and compliance, and getting credit for your work, it actually becomes an enabler for the business rather than a blocker.
That's wild to me that having more structured conversations around risk actually makes things better.
Yeah, that's the whole idea, right? Like, there'd be no point in coming to work in the morning if we didn't really believe that
right.
make it better for people. Now, it was like, that goes back to the mission in the first place. Like, by default, a lot of this stuff is really frustrating for people, and it doesn't need to be. We've seen these improvements happen in all kinds of areas of business where work is frustrating, from automating system configuration to monitoring to various business processes. And this is just another one where there's some really exciting ways of thinking about the problem have started to come together.
Mm, yeah, absolutely. You mentioned there's your four-step process. We've hit three. What's your number four?
So fourth is about like a learning organization, right? So you got the first step of building empathy, right? Just like giving yourself the headspace to actually think about the problem. Two is mm-hmm. your controls baseline. That's your minimum bar. Three is doing your scenario-based risk assessment with OpenFair. And then four is, so the scenario-based risk assessment, that's where you're actually like doing unique things to your company, not just a lowest common denominator, but unique things that reduce risk or help you manage risk for this things that are unique to your company, the unique challenges you face. And then four is about continuous improvement. How do you actually get better year after year? How do you make sure that all of the people across your organization are able to help you get better? And so there's a second framework from Lance Hayden called FORCE, the FORCE metrics. And I just love the work he did in this people-centric security book. So FORCE is an acronym. And these 25 metrics are about benefiting from these five different domains. So the five domains are failure, operations, resilience, complexity, and expertise. Those are dramatically different metrics than how many security incidents did we have last year. And thinking somehow that if you bully people into not reporting security incidents, that you're somehow doing better as a company, right? And then those metrics, like when you talk about like learning from failure, building resilience, benefiting from complexity and expertise, that directly leads you to doing some of the other good practices from the DevOps and site reliability worlds, like experiential learning with game day exercises, using different analysis frameworks like Kinevin for helping make sense of very unknown, chaotic areas that you might be exploring, and then trying to move the work in those different complexity domains to be more well understood, more structured, and just like thinking about it, just like with risk, thinking about it in a more structured way. When you start doing that in the organization, it is amazing. Just doing the survey for the FORCE metrics the first time, the conversations that come out of it, right? You'll have a management team say, we are absolutely 100% agree with this, this, and this. And you'll have an engineering team say, we completely disagree that we do any of those things. And you'll have a business team split down the middle. And just the ability that the organization has to learn from that temperature taking and then improve their communication and change some of their practices, that gets into this virtuous cycle where you have the company improving and everybody's talking about how to do it better. And they're engaged and they're doing a genuinely better job. And the quality improvements and the safety improvements that you're going to get from that are so far beyond what you get from a compliance checklist, the minimum bar.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm seeing kind of two different directions you could come from, that you could come from on this sort of compliance stuff. One, you've got the startup who's just learned they have to become HIPAA compliant to go after some customers they want, or they've just been acquired. And two, you've got people working in very large process and compliance oriented companies that are trying to become more nimble. They're trying to take advantage of more stuff in the market they could be doing. So for the startup and for the large enterprise, and they're trying to come out different directions or move in different directions, do you have advice for each one?
So the startups, I think we've talked about a little bit more, right, with setting a controls baseline and then doing the scenario-based risk assessment.
Right.
In a larger enterprise, you probably already have the controls baseline. You probably already have a lot of process, and you're trying to bring more innovation in. That is kind of the amazing thing about this open fair standard for doing quantitative based risk assessment, mm-hmm. because just as much as it shows you where you have where you can add controls, it also shows you where you're over controlled. And so in the fair model, risk is very clearly defined in a dollar value and with probability. And so the way you measure risk, the quantity that you use, is annual loss exposure. And then the inputs for that are loss events and loss magnitudes. And so you multiply the probability of your loss events by the probability of the loss magnitudes, and you have a probability distribution that says, like, we might lose between, 80% chance of losing between $10,000 and $20,000 next year. So you can think about it like a real easy example to think about is like stealing laptops, right? What's my risk of losing laptops next year? We've got 100 people in the company. We've got 100 laptops. We have this much travel. Maybe you do all of the work and you figure like our loss magnitude per laptop that we lose is probably $3,000. On the upper end, it might be $10,000. And probably we're going to lose between 4 and 10 laptops next year, right? And there's like all kinds of techniques you can use to do those estimates. But that gives you a number.
Right.
And so then in a highly controlled environment where you're trying to enable some innovation, doing that type of risk analysis around the new proposed activity can be totally eye-opening. Like, okay, what's our loss exposure from this activity? It was like, well, you have no controls in this environment. You want to do all this stuff. You're going to have very high loss events. Like, sure. But what's your loss magnitudes? Oh, well, there's actually no customer data in the environment. And worst case, we might lose a few $1,000s because of X, Y, or Z. Like, you can have a way better quality decision based on that.
I think a lot of people listening, especially like myself, I've personally been experienced this, where you realize that your team, your company they're spending $500,000 to protect against a $10,000 loss.
Exactly.
And we're like, I think you've got it backwards.
Yeah. And that just doesn't make sense. And that's why like one size fits all doesn't cut it. It's also why you have to put in the work around being able to communicate, get credit for your work, right? You might be able to intuitively jump to the conclusion that it's fine for me to try this experiment, but it's really worth learning how to communicate like the risk analysis that you've done, mm-hmm. and that you're capable of complying with processes in other parts of the business, so that you're like permitted to go off and do those things. You can't just jump straight to the end and not show your work.
Right. As much as I tell my math teacher in high school that I totally can, it doesn't work like that in the real world, especially not when you have a company that must remain compliant. Like if you have auditors and regulatory people talking to your company, like, you kind of want to stay off the SEC's radar.
Yeah, you want to stay off their radar, but I think even more important than that, you want to be able to prove that you're doing a good job.
Right.
If people are questioning, and that manifests in like very important ways. You might want to prove that like when bad event X happens, we weren't negligent, and therefore people can stay out of jail. and in a the broader and broader you look across multiple departments, multiple companies, multiple countries, like bad stuff happens every day. And it's super, super important to put in the work that you're meeting a reasonable standard of care. And you see this really prominently in healthcare. I think we need to start using those same sort of mental models across all of tech.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's interesting you mentioned healthcare because healthcare in the US particularly there's a lot of healthcare startups, and there's a lot of healthcare innovation happening, but it feels like the hospitals and the large organizations are just now catching up. I'm starting to see a lot of innovation from the insurance companies about just how they manage their systems, how they approach these problems. And in fact, it seems like a lot of the insurance companies are doing a better job than some of the startups I've seen as far as innovation and how they think about risk. Then again, that's also the entire reason why they exist.
That's the entire reason they exist, and they've been doing it for over 100 years, right? It is amazing how much there is to learn from the insurance world, from actuarial science and things like that. Some of those techniques, which were incredibly labor-intensive or incredibly expensive, are now available to anybody with a spreadsheet or a Jupyter notebook. And that's sort of what's really exciting, is that these tried and true techniques for working with risk calculations are like now available to absolutely anyone.
Yeah, which is just wild to me. Like that's so cool.
For sure.
So we've talked quite a bit about kind of theory of compliance and what all this means and how people can work to improve it. What's something that people can do today or this week? Like something much more actionable.
So I think sort of the biggest set of tools you can immediately take on as an individual is understanding how to think about quantitative risk and like sort of recalibrating the way you think about measuring uncertainty. And so the thing I would ask everybody to do is read the book How to Measure Anything in Cybersecurity.
I love the is there actually a separate book, How to Measure Anything in Cybersecurity?
There is. So there's a co-author. So that's Douglas awesome. Hubbard wrote the original famous How to Measure Anything.
Which I have read, and it's a wonderful book. But then again, I really hope you like Monte Carlo simulations, because, oh boy, you get some.
Yeah, you're going to get some. So then there's a much more recent book called How to Measure Anything in Cybersecurity, and there's a co-author for that one. I think it's Richard Searson. I probably got the name wrong, but that one tends to get much more concrete with applying the techniques in the domain of cybersecurity. But just reading through that will completely change your ability to talk about it and think about it and make decisions about it.
Yeah. And piggybacking off of that recommendation, I also highly recommend reading the original for those who haven't. It is also a wonderful book and like opens your eyes to measurements, things that like, how do you calculate, how do you measure something that seems unmeasurable?
Yeah.
Well, everything is actually measurable. And like measuring a movement from one place to another is actually a measurement. How much did it change? Well, that's a different question. And you mentioned this earlier about there's a 20% chance that we're going to lose between this much money and this other much money.
Yeah.
And that's actually a valid measurement. And most people only think in terms of absolute measurements, but we don't have to.
Absolutely. And that is the big idea, right? Is that Hubbard points out that measurement is reduction in uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And that's such a useful definition, because you can say, there's no way for me to estimate that. Like, well, is it more than a million? Oh, definitely not. Is it more than one? Definitely. Like, oh, well, now we've got a measurement. And then there's other things we can do to kind of narrow that measurement. And we're never going to get it down to a single point, maybe, but you can then do useful calculations with that range of probabilities.
Yeah, that's amazing. All right. Well, Elliot, it has been fantastic having you on here. Where can people find out more about you and your work?
So my consulting company is kindlyops.com. We publish a bunch of articles there about this stuff, conference talks, open source tools that make some of this stuff easier. So kindlyops.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to the Real World DevOps Podcast. If you want to stay up to date on the latest episodes, you can find us at realworlddevops.com and on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever it is you get your podcasts. I'll see you in the next episode.
This has been a Humble Pod production.
Stay humble.